Hi, everyone. We're going to wait just one more minute to let people get on the line. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the April Monthly Policy Update. I'm Brenna Stroop with Independent Sector. Today, we'll be joined by my IS colleagues, Jamie Tucker, Allison Grayson, and Becca Busick, as well as Wes Coulomb from Washington Council, Ernst & Young. This month, we are also welcoming our new colleague, Ben Kershaw. Many of you probably know Ben from his previous job at American Alliance of Museums. This is Ben's second week at IS, and we are very excited to put him out on the field today to talk during the Monthly Policy Update. I also want to take a moment to give a special shout out to Jamie. As many of you likely know, Jamie has been working remotely from North Carolina for the last few months, and this is likely to be his last monthly policy update. Unless, of course, we can get Jamie to come back to IS for a third term at a later moment. We just wanted to do a special thank you to Jamie for all of his hard work, and he's been an amazing colleague for all of us. So. Thank you, Jamie, and we hope that you will continue to listen in on our policy updates in the future. Before we get into the rest of today's agenda, I want to go over a few housekeeping details. As always, this is all the lines are currently muted, and we will pause periodically for questions. If you do have questions or comments throughout the call, you may press *6 to unmute yourself, and we ask that you please mute yourself again when you're done. If you have any technical difficulties throughout the call, you are welcome to email me at brennas@independentsector.org, and we are looking forward to your questions today. We really appreciate your attendance, and I will turn it over to Jamie now if he's able to get back on the line. Are you there, Jamie? Well, we may cut to Wes then, if you're there, Wes. I think Jamie was having a little bit of issues on the phone. If you want to start off the update for today.
I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it sounds great.
Great. Thanks, Brenna. Welcome this afternoon. Good to be with you. I'll just give a quick legislative update on what's going on Capitol Hill these days. The House and Senate are finished up their business this week. They'll be out next week and then back for 3 weeks in the month of May. As you may have seen, the House passed a series of IRS taxpayer-friendly type reforms to the IRS procedures and processes, and they're going to then send the bill off to the Senate for further consideration. That legislation was actually various different bills in the House, and they passed it into one bill, sent over to the Senate, had a number of items in there relating to IRS procedures, appeals process, how to deal with IRS and taxpayers, and kind of reform the process for IRS dealing with taxpayers going forward. One provision in that bill, in that package, would also affect the nonprofit sector and would require Form 990s to be filed electronically and also open for public inspection. We anticipate that bill, that piece of legislation, to also be included in the Senate legislation when they put that bill together. I understand the Senate Finance Committee staff is working with the IRS as well as with Senator Hatch and Senator Wyden's staff on the Finance Committee to try to put together a companion bill in the Senate to pass over there to go with what the House already passed on that IRS front. It will not likely look exactly like the House package and have some differences in there, some additions and some subtractions from what the House passed, as I understand it. I'm looking to do that sometime in the late May, possibly a June timeframe, the Senate Finance Committee. And we expect, as I mentioned, that provision from the House required electronically filed Form 990s to also be included in the Senate package when they put that together next month. We'll see how that plays out, what actually is included in that that bigger package. After that, the Senate is really processing a lot of nominations. We do have the IRS commissioner nominee still out there. The Senate Finance Committee still has not held a hearing on him. They do have his paperwork, and they're still processing the paperwork and the background information for that nomination. We expect that sometime probably the latter part of May to have a hearing and hopefully process that shortly thereafter as well. In addition to that, as you saw, the budget process has been done through September of this year. There's been talk about doing some appropriations bills in the summer months in the House and potentially in the Senate. With some conversation between the House and Senate Appropriations Committees on the overall budget numbers. As you know, earlier this year they reached a two-year budget deal to increase the defense and non-defense budget caps to help ease the way for appropriations bills to get passed. Then they passed the omnibus bill, obviously, last month. I still don't think that's going to be enough to get them to be able to pass appropriations bills on a regular order basis for the House and Senate for September. But I think they're going to try to do something on that front on individual bills this summer. And my expectation is they'll probably be forced into their CR September to get them past the election sometime in the fall so they finish up all the budget appropriations process at that time. So I'll just kind of stop there and see if there's any questions or other comments that folks might have on the schedule or the any update.
Hey, Wes, this is Jamie. I've since corrected some technical things I'm on. Thank you for getting us kicked off.
Oh, good. Sure.
Well, one question I want to ask you as others kind of ready and prepare is that we have seen some news out of the White House, not uncommon, some discussion of potential budget rescissions. I know, I think a court decision or something else determined that it blocked a potential rescission or defunding of Planned Parenthood. There might be others that are out there, it doesn't seem that many of the more egregious rescissions will become possibilities. Some of the things that the White House may have prioritized in their budget, especially. Wondering if you have any thought about that process and what might be coming down the pipe there.
Yeah, good question, Jamie. President Trump during the signing, ceremony for the omnibus appropriations bill, on that day was very negative on the package. Obviously agreed to sign it into law, but was, complaining about the size of the package, increase in spending, and then shortly thereafter they made comments about setting up some rescissions to undo some of the spending in the bill. I've heard reports about a rescissions package of $60 billion in size to the overall package, which is actually quite substantial, which is obviously their right as the White House and OMB to do that, which has been done in previous administrations, going back a long time. Not only, I don't think that size or that scope, but they do offer up rescissions for unspent funds and so forth in times past. My guess is that this will not go very far. There might be some support for it in the Republican circles, especially in the House and some in the Senate. But I think even Leader McConnell in the Senate said that they don't expect to take up a rescissions package, that they agreed to the budget deal last month, and they don't intend to undo a sizable portion of it. Obviously, those issues could come back up later on this fall when they negotiate a new budget. But my guess is that the president will submit, as they said they intend to do, a rescissions package, that it might get some play in the House, but I do not think it will go very far in the Senate, given what Senator McConnell has said about it. So there'll be a lot of talk, a lot of sound bites and speeches, but I don't think at the end of the day there will be much rescissions get done, if any, between now and September on those items.
Thanks, Wes. And as Wes noted, we'll pause here for a moment, see if anyone has any questions on kind of the overall landscape or upcoming schedule. All right, hearing none, we'll move on to talk a bit about tax policy. And Wes, you've been involved in some of these meetings and conversations with the Washington Council team, and I know at last month's policy update, some time was spent discussing an effort with Senator Stabenow's office on the Senate side to potentially introduce some charitable giving legislation, whether that is a more expansive version of a universal charitable deduction or something else that complements charitable giving or expands charitable giving across the country, something we're continuing to work on with our partners throughout the sector, those here in D.C. as part of the Charitable Giving Coalition as well. One of the things that we will do post this call is we have kind of pulled together a summary document of some of the conversations we've had both with this group, within the working group, and with other groups affiliated with the coalition about some baseline concerns, thoughts of what a piece of legislation might look like. I know Sarah Shive and Stabenow's office has been very open and receptive to putting something forward and really wants buy-in from the sector and advice from the sector on how best to craft this with some minimum parameters discussed. I think for them, certainly, they prioritize progressivity and the tax code, finding a way, as she put it, to bring in as many taxpayers as possible in this regime. Certainly, a universal charitable deduction has the potential to do that, but that is not the only way we might be able to accomplish this through legislative means, and we are continuing those conversations. But as I noted, something that we will send out the summary document to give you a sense of where the conversations are going, what has been discussed thus far. We are not at the point of putting down hard legislative proposals. I think there's still some work to do to evaluate a number of proposals that have been put on the table over any term of years. Lots of folks have done good thinking on this. There's been great research done on it. We're doing the best we can to get our heads around it, to try to put at least a menu ahead forward to Senator Stabenow's office for some consideration. And we want to involve as many voices as possible as part of that process. So Wes, and also to our new colleague, Ben Kershaw, who's been part of this effort, I kick you for a moment to see if there's anything else we should add in terms of this charitable giving piece. I know this year, very difficult to try to move individual legislation. There might be some possibilities of doing it, but the window is very small. This is more of a longer game, thinking more about future years once we have a better understanding of the impact of the tax law. So you guys have been in the conversations. Is there anything else, for the good of the group, we should discuss about what's happening and what might be moving?
Yeah, I'll kick off first as Wes. I mean, everyone's kind of familiar with the process we went through with the big tax bill in December and how it did not include universal deduction. There was lots of efforts to make that happen and just didn't make it across the finish line. I think there is, as you mentioned, interest on Capitol Hill, both the House and Senate, Republican Democrats, to see what they can do to help on the charitable giving side and to open looking at universal deduction type proposals. Obviously, the question is around what does that look like? Is there caps similar to what's in the Walker bill? Are there other changes need to be done on the substantiation side if you're going to do it to everybody and not just itemizers, for example? Like, there's also a sense that they need to have a little bit more data as to what's happening in the charitable giving space to help educate the staff and members on the Hill about what's going on in the marketplace. But I think there is openness to looking at some ideas, and so I think that we need to do more education to think about how the sector wants to approach this. And I think there is openness to doing something in the future on an itemized or non-itemizer above line deduction in this area. One thing I'll point out is I agree with you that this year is going to be more of an education kind of building the foundation type exercise of a year, but there is an effort that I didn't mention that the House in particular is looking to do a second tax bill really around making individual tax provisions that were sunset in the 2017 bill to make those provisions permanent, the rate cuts, et cetera, standard deduction increase as well. That should come about, my guess, sometime late summer, probably not until October or September when they have that debate on the House floor. And the idea would be to make the tax cuts permanent on the individual side as part of that exercise. That obviously will open the debate to talk about the charitable deduction again as part of that. I don't see really a good chance of us being able to insert a provision in there to add to that bill. The Republicans don't want to do that. They just want to kind of make the current provisions that they passed in December permanent as part of the exercise, but it'll open up the discussion to think about how we can kind of further educate folks about the trail reduction and think about universal reduction as an idea to look forward to thinking about in a future exercise sometime later.
Thanks, Wes. I know I put Ben a bit on the spot, and I kicked to him and Brenna just for a moment because they've been having, you know, general meetings with folks on tax policy. It does seem that having data is very important for many members on both sides of the aisle before we're able to kind of think about what a package might look like.
Thanks, Jamie. I would just sort of echo what Wes said, that there does seem to be some productive interest on both sides of the Capitol about advancing legislation to expand charitable giving. We continue to engage, full throttle in those discussions, and we'll certainly keep this group posted should we have further developments on that. I have a quick question for Wes about the tax bill number 2 you mentioned. The months you mentioned that coming up are the months of September and October, and it struck me that the month following that is the month of November. Do you think this is a serious policy effort, or do you think there might be other things in mind?
No, that's a good question, Ben. I think that, and it could happen before the summer in July, but I think that there's a sense that might want to do it closer to the election, because this exercise is more about keeping the tax bill and the benefits of the tax cuts. The Republicans are posturing it in the minds of the voters, and so they can kind of point to, you know, more tax relief before they go to the poll. People go to the polls in November. So, there's no question this is more about just making the arguments on the tax cut side, because there's good indication that Senator McConnell is hesitant to bring it up in the Senate, and if he did, it probably would not pass, because you would need Democrats to support it to pass it in the Senate, absent reconciliation instructions, which they don't have. And so it's more of an exercise of talking points and not real likelihood of getting it passed through the Senate and the President's desk.
Thanks, Wes. We're going to go on to another big issue on the tax front in just a moment, but I do want to pause. Any questions related to the charitable giving piece, anything Wes has mentioned in terms of timing for potential legislation or kind of the general landscape for charitable giving in 2018? All right, well, moving right along to the very exciting issue of unrelated business income tax, something that became a part of the final tax legislation and now tax law that was discussed as a possibility. It did not really show up until later drafts of the bill end of last year. Two provisions from our perspective that we have been watching and working to better understand very closely. One related to the fringe benefits, kind of the taxation of fringe benefits for nonprofit organizations, and two, the what is known as silo accounting, and for nonprofits no longer being able to use losses from one venture to kind of offset any potential unrelated gains in another on the for tax exempt organizations. I will say that very complex issues. The way things are drafted at the moment, there's not a lot of understanding how either would really apply. The good news is that IS has a tremendous number of resources. Recently did a podcast on Voices for Good, had some experts, and one of our longtime members and friends, Heather Noonan from the League of American Orchestras, was kind enough to come on and have a conversation with us. The folks from Ropes and Gray have wonderful resources, additional podcasts, all posted on the Independent Sector website, as well as our friends at the National Council for Nonprofits, and of course, ASAE have done a fantastic job in trying to really elevate this issue to get folks to better understand exactly how it might apply. There's a lot of concern, again, about how things are drafted, about what really, on the fringe benefit issue in particular, what really would constitute a fringe benefit. I mean, it could range from anything from a nonprofit owning a parking lot to having on-site athletic facilities, whereas before an organization may not have to file a 990, 490T, or even a more complex form, might have to make some changes. in the 2018 year. I will say that a broader coalition has been talking about this, talking with policymakers and the Treasury. I'll turn to Ben in a moment, who was at a meeting with Treasury this week, having some discussions around these new provisions a bit. One of the things that this group is asking for is, a hopeful retroactive delay in implementation of the provisions until the IRS has the opportunity to hear more from stakeholders and to promulgate rules so we really do understand exactly how these are going to apply. So, Ben, I turn to you now. I know you're at the Treasury meeting, wondering, your thoughts coming out of that and where we might be going next.
Thanks, Jamie. So yes, my colleagues and friends at the independent sector have thrown me into the fire right away, meeting with Treasury on UBIT regulations. So I'm grateful to them for that. It was a really productive, I think, and useful meeting this week at the Department of Treasury. We're grateful again to our friends at ASAE for organizing it. Over 20 practitioners representing a broad swath of the nonprofit community. And, I would say that the asks from the nonprofit community, centered around trying to get a better understanding of what will apply, what expenditures will be newly subject to UBIT. This was sort of a meeting specifically on the fringe benefits side. The coalition has a lot of, we think, really persuasive arguments that this expansion of UBIT is a bad idea. Arguments that center around many nonprofits being required to provide these fringe benefits based on local regulations where they operate. Arguments based on the ludicrous idea of newly subjecting an expenditure to UBIT rather than income. The I in UBIT stands for income, it doesn't stand for expenditure. So this is a really strange way that Congress has chosen to pursue this. At the end of the day, though, many of those arguments will be more powerful when our coalition brings them to Congress. The press from Treasury is for certainty, and I would say both at that meeting this week and at another meeting at the Georgetown University Law Center Continuing Legal Education Seminar earlier today, folks from Treasury reiterated that they understand there is great uncertainty in the nonprofit community about both the siloing rules and fringe benefit rules. And they understand that estimated tax payments were due already, despite the fact that there's not guidance as to what nonprofits might owe. And they have assured the community they're working as hard as they can to get more specific guidance about what is owed out. But unfortunately, we are all left waiting for that guidance and making best guesses in the meantime.
Thank you, Ben. And you mentioned one thing I should have pointed out is that one of the reasons this is a bit confusing is because for the first time, at least on our side of things, UBIT's being applied to expenditures rather than revenue. So really understanding how that's supposed to work and what that looks like is going to be a challenge. And I think finding clarity, as important as it is for the Treasury, certainly important for all of our organizations. Wes, I turn to you just for a moment for some context. We were lucky enough with our public policy committee to sit down with Victoria Glover, who's majority tax counsel for the Ways and Means Committee last week. We talked a little bit with her about this. I think her advice in some ways was to make sure to communicate this both to them and to Treasury, whether sort of informing through comments or just sort of general concerns. On a congressional landscape, do you think there may be opportunities to, whether it be potentially through, and I hate to say a technical corrections bill or something else, to kind of make clarifications or changes to this piece this year? Or is this more something that we're going to have to kind of focus on through a regulatory stance with the Treasury?
Yeah, I think that there's value to having kind of a two-prong approach to this, given the significant impacts it's going to have on the sector and the complexity of it and the confusion around it. Obviously, the probably given the legislative landscape at the moment, legislation is going to be difficult to achieve. Given you're kind of want to delay the effective date possibly, or to make some clarifications to it. And they're just not, let's say, vehicles that are going to move the president's desk. They're looking to add things to technically correct or fix the 2017 tax bill. There is some things out there they need to fix, but the Democrats have been in the posture of not trying to fix the bill they were not part of and did not support. And so it's going to be hard to get that, across the finish line. But, something we definitely should put our proposal together and kind of work them with folks on the Hill to get some interest, to get some education going, because I think people don't really realize the breadth and the scope of this provision and how it's going to impact the sector. I don't think they really understood it. They went through the process and probably need a lot of education to understand what they did, how they did it. Victoria, for example, started talking about, we were trying to do some parity with the corporate sector, with the nonprofit sector, and that might sound right, but in these cases, there really is not really an apples-to-apples comparison, and the parity argument doesn't really hold up, in my view, on the fringe benefit side. Now you're trying to tax, as you point out, using UBIT as a vehicle to tax nonprofits because you took away some benefits on the corporate side. So we need some education, definitely on the Hill, talk about what was done. The more pressing, I think, would be to further the conversation with Treasury, as Ben points out in those meetings, to develop some points to get them, hopefully, as they go through the guidance process, they do have some authority to make some adjustments here, to hopefully make the rules a little more workable and helpful. They can't, fix everything, of course, but I think we definitely need to kind of focus first and foremost would be on the regulatory process with Treasury and IRS, because they're trying to get their guidance out in the next several months, this year. And working with them on that would be, I think, the first avenue I would pursue. But definitely don't give up on the legislative side, because we definitely need to keep educating folks about it, and hopefully there'll be a chance sometime in the future to get this corrected.
Thank you, Wes. All right. Before moving on to the next item on the agenda, we're going to stop, pause for any questions internally, externally on UBIT, where things might be moving, anything that's been said so far. All right, thank you, Ben. You tackled that admirably. The next item on the agenda, another issue that we are following pretty closely in coalition with other organizations is the public student loan forgiveness issue. There's been some effort, we know, by the Trump administration to completely abolish the program. Well, certainly this program has been very important to nonprofit organizations as part of talent recruitment, as a way to get folks who might otherwise pass upon higher salaries in the for-profit sector to come on and do great work with nonprofit organizations. Brenna, I know you've been working with the coalition following this issue closely. What can you tell us about what's going on right now?
Yeah, really quick before I jump in, was there somebody who had a question? It sounded like maybe somebody was talking. Okay, if not, you can ask again later. So as many of you likely know, last month Congress included a $350 million increase to the public student loan forgiveness program in fiscal year 2018 and 2019 budgets. And this included funding for outreach efforts to educate and market the program for those who are in need. So that's kind of good news. Similarly to any program that's been around for a few years, there are conversations about reforming the program right now that are going on. On the Senate side, most of this conversation is coming out of Senator Alexander's office. The talked about changes have revolved around restricting particular jobs from the program. And these mostly include high paying jobs like lawyers or doctors who are considered to be able to pay off their loans full themselves. However, there have been conversations about restricting those who work at charities and foundations that have a significant amount of money as well, which is very concerning to us. And it is common for nonprofit employees to move around in the sector frequently, so this can be very problematic. On the bright side, Senator Alexander's office has said that he doesn't think this will happen this year. So we do have time to organize and be prepared if this conversation moves forward. And as part of the Public Student Loan Forgiveness Coalition, we've heard that many organizations have been doing fly-ins over the last month or so with current students who are planning to utilize the program, and this has been very effective. So thank you to all the students who are out there doing the hard work. So there's nothing imminent on this at the moment, but there has been some movement on the House side. Representative Virginia Fox from North Carolina has introduced the PROSPER Act, which would eliminate the public student loan forgiveness program for any future students by eliminating direct loans. We are hearing that the Senate has no interest in this bill, which is good news as well. There was a briefing on the PROSPER Act last week, which had fairly underwhelming attendance, which we also considered to be a very high note. And there has been a dozen or so House Republicans that have signed on to a letter in opposition to the PROSPER Act. And the coalition has been doing, has been making a conscious effort to show gratitude for their opposition. While this is all mostly good news, we know that we have to keep the efforts up. So if you're interested in joining the coalition or being an ally, please let us know and we're happy to connect you. And right now they are putting a large focus on the states of Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Wyoming, Maine, Tennessee, Utah, and Alaska. Hopefully I'm not missing any. And if you also are looking for more information, our colleague Allison did a very helpful blog post last month around this as well. So I definitely recommend checking that out.
Thank you so much, Brenna. And I will add, you know, for Representative Fox, she is the chairwoman of the Education and Workforce Committee in the House. So at least on that side of the Hill, there is some heft behind this and some direction. I know the Senate doesn't have much interest right now, but, you know, things could change. It might be a tough vote to take in an election year, but still something that is prioritized by the administration and certainly by the leadership of that committee on the House side. So I will stop if anyone has any questions on this issue or anything else that we've talked about up to this point. Happy to answer.
All
right, hearing none.
This is Harvey Dale. Is there a self-help issue to avoid the silo problem for separate calculation of profits and losses for UBIT purposes simply by downstreaming the separate businesses into a C corporation? And what problems would that cause, if any?
Harvey, that's a great question. Wes, have you heard anything on this or how that might be treated?
Good question, Harvey. I have not. I mean, obviously, if you do a, you know, C corporation, you're subject to tax on that. But I've not heard about that particular structure as a way to get around the siloing provision. But I'm sure there are people that I can talk to folks here at EY or think about different options to help alleviate some of the burden from that. But I've not heard of that particular structure myself.
Well, It is what C corporations do. They automatically can offset losses and gains. They're at the same 21% tax as the UBIT would apply. So I don't see the downside to it. But I think there may be some risks if there are shared facilities or shared services, because that creates an allocation question. I think it ought to be explored, because if it can be worked in most instances, it's pretty simple. And it simply undoes the silo problem and its self-help.
Great. Thank you, Harvey. Any other questions?
Hey, Harvey, this is Ben Kershaw. The only thing that comes to mind about that is that I know, you know, Wes alluded to this, when Ways and Means and others have discussed the need for this change in, you know, siloing, they've talked about it and keeping parity with the net operating loss deductions that were repealed on the C Corp side in tax reform. So I don't know, I do not know whether that would factor into what you're contemplating, but just worth keeping in mind that they were looking at it in terms of parity with net operating loss being repealed as a deduction.
The NOL rules would be parallel in both cases. The only thing that would become parallel is the ability of both a for-profit group and a nonprofit group to offset current losses against current gains, which is what the siloing provision prevents for nonprofits only. So it is, by definition, the opposite of a level playing field.
Thank you.
We agree, Harvey. Any other questions or comments? All right, hearing none, we're going to turn to our colleague, Becca Busick, who's going to talk a little bit more about our ongoing partnership with Nonprofit Vote, particularly as we are in an election year. Becca?
Thanks, Jamie. Yeah, so as many of you know, Independent Sector works and has worked on voter engagement for several years. We've been a close partner with Nonprofit Vote in quite a variety of events and resource production and whatnot. We have just recently partnered with Nonprofit Vote, as had Council on Foundations, to put out two new toolkits, one for community foundations and one for private foundations, on how they can support charities in voter engagement through grants and communications and a variety of other avenues. So those toolkits can be found on our website as well as on nonprofitvote.org. And like I said, as you know, we're increasing our voter engagement. So we're actually putting together right now a list of organizations that do voter registration. So if your organization participates in any kind of voter registration, voter engagement, any kind of activities, if you could please be in touch with us. We'd really like to put together an all-inclusive list of organizations that do this, as we believe it's very important to advancing our missions to get our constituents and our communities involved in elections, and if they support our issues, even better. But just the spreading of democracy is obviously very important to us. So we'd really like to put together any resources that can help nonprofits do that. So if you're already doing this work, thank you. And just please be in touch with us there so we can continue to increase our voter engagement work.
Thank you, Becca. Before doing another round of questions, I'm going to stick with you for a minute to talk a little bit about Upswell and the progress going on there. And I think some of the policy sessions and content are being developed now, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So we are in the process of brainstorming, putting together some further along than others. We are putting together a variety of sessions. There will be a breakout workshop type schedule block over the course of a couple of days. The sessions will be focused on policy. There will also be policy throughout Upswell, throughout the full event, and not just at the event itself, the three-day in-person, but they're a good portion of our colleagues are actually in LA right now. They're on their way back. They just finished up a lab where they're working with the LA community. We're going to be in Chicago, Detroit, a couple other cities as well, just pulling together groups on the ground for content and best practices and things like that that are going on. So right now we're in the process of developing content. So if you have content ideas, speaker ideas, any suggestions for how to engage with attendees before, during, and after, please be in touch with me. Obviously, registration is open right now. The earlier you register, the cheaper it is. So just a shameless plug there to go ahead, get on upswell.org, I believe it is, to register. And if you have any questions, just contact me. It's RebeccaV@independentsector.org.
Thank you again, Becca. All right, I'm going to pause one last time for any questions. Anything that Becca just talked about in terms of voter engagement or Upswell? All right, well, hearing none, we'll kick back to you on the phone one last time. If there's anything else brewing in particular on the nonprofit side, certainly we talked about a number of issues that we're following closely. We know you in the field have even more of great importance, things that matter to you and the folks you serve. If there are things that we can lift up here at Independent Sector, lift up to the federal level in particular, we're happy to do so. So please let us know what you're tracking, what you're following, what you're concerned about, and issues that you think that our organization should be taking a more proactive lead on. We're happy to have those conversations and step out and do the work necessary to serve the sector. I do want to add, for me on a personal note, I think that Brennan mentioned that this will be my final MPU with Independent Sector. Very grateful to have someone of the caliber of Ben coming in behind. He's fantastic. Many of you may know him. from his time with the American Alliance of Museums. I've known him for 5 years. He's a great professional. He'll be a fantastic fit with the team, and you'll be hearing a lot from him on these calls and others. And that's a benefit to the organization and to the sector. As for me, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend time with you every month doing this and doing other activities with the independent sector. I don't think I'll ever be too far away from the organization, and certainly will continue to follow. But I'm grateful for my time and for everyone on the IS team and for the partnership we have with the Washington Council and for all of you for participating every month and for being such great partners with us and for stepping up and stepping out and doing the great work. I won't be talking to you in May, but the rest of the team will. We look forward to connecting with you in the final Thursday of May. Hope you all have a wonderful next few weeks. We'll keep you updated as other issues come up. And again, my thanks to our colleagues at Washington Council and the IS team for helping put together this call today. And thank you for your questions. Thank you, Harvey, for yours as well. We'll continue to follow up on what you suggested and see if that might be a good workaround. So again, my gratitude and thanks to you. And we'll talk to you again next month.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks, Jamie.